I was off.
Okay, it wasn't just me this time.
No. All
right.
Usually you're crazy, but not this time.
Welcome to another episode of Jabber and the Drone, the movie review podcast that politely disagrees to agree. From Portland, Oregon, not Portland, Maine, West Coast, keeping it West Side, Richard Wally.
You need to stop that. I've been watching The Wire. That can get us in some major trouble.
You don't want to start a rap battle or a podcast battle with, I don't know. Do we have any East Coast
rivals? No.
Rivals?
No, and we're not hard. I don't want to do that. By the way, you're Cassidy Robinson. You're from the L.A. area, Los Angeles.
Mm-hmm.
You tell me your neighborhood, but I forget. It probably has a San in it.
You just say West L.A. I don't know. I try and tell... Because if I tell people I'm from Venice, that's kind of a lie because I'm not really in Venice. Because they're like, oh, you go to the boardwalk all the time. I'm like, nope, never been. It's like a mile from my house, but I've never been there. or if I tell people I'm in Marina Del Rey... which I'm also really close to, and they're like, oh, yeah, you go over to the boats and stuff. It's like, yeah, I've seen it once.
Well, you know.
Or if I tell people I'm in Santa Monica, that's really a lie, even though, again, it only takes, like, 5 minutes to get there. I couldn't afford to cross that, I don't know, that division between where I live and what is Santa Monica.
Right. Well, I get excited when you say Santa Monica, but I always get confused.
Because you think of the...
Yeah.
You think of the Everclear song?
No. It's Santa Barbara is what I'm thinking of.
Yeah, no, that's like up
north. Or Santa Clara. Sorry. No, not even Barbara.
Well, Santa Clara is a fictitious city.
Yeah.
That was in the Lost Boys. Based.
I get excited, though, still.
Based, I think, on Santa Barbara, which is up in North Bay area.
Right.
Yeah. Right. Which I've never been. So, but I'm in the crosshairs of West LA. Who cares?
No, nobody does. We got in a very long conversation about it.
Not even a single person. So this time, last time, I jumped the gun and I said it's a new year. Now it is officially 2016.
Yeah, you lied last time.
That's my favorite thing.
Well, I just have to do it tell everybody every time. I have a log going. I'm just going to build them up, and then one day I'm going to spring it on you. This is when you said your lie. This.
like I'm on the stand, like I'm in court.
Yeah. I have a plan.
I'm excited for that.
It'll be a strange episode.
A really weird episode.
I just wanted to prove to everybody that you have a long-standing history.
Let it stand. The record shows that on June 8th, 2011...
That's something we should... I mean, maybe we should have done that as a podcast.
If we had... Well,
we should have done the court cast, you know?
Court cast. I'm sure somebody is.
I'm sure they are, but, you know, we need to be more unique.
Well,
we've talked about this.
Now the new hot thing is true crime, because we have Serial and this murder show on Netflix, and it's the hot thing.
Yeah, if we would have done it, if we would have jumped on right away.
Mm-hmm, if we had known. We would have had the foresight that people were really super into... cold cases, then we could have rebranded immediately.
Oh, you mean like there's like 30 years of people doing cold cases on like A&E and stuff like that, if we would have known. It was remarkable. It's never been heard of before. True crime.
I went and saw the movie that we're going to be reviewing today, which is Quentin Tarantino's The Hateful Eight.
Mm-hmm.
I went and saw it at Tarantino's theater here in town, the New Beverly, which I say Tarantino's theater, like he's there in the ticket booth, like, hey, welcome to the New Beverly. Like, no, I think he makes guest appearances whenever he is in town and has the time and, you know, wants to go through the hassle of signing 150 programs.
Well, he came to a Hollywood theater.
I saw that. I saw that your friends did that whole thing.
Yeah, and then I was here with you.
You're welcome. So I went down there. I figured, well, you know, I'm seeing The Hateful Eight, and it's so hard to get into these roadshow screenings because they sell out online so fast. But the cool thing about the Beverly is they sell 100 tickets. It's like a 200-seat theater, and they sell 100 tickets online, and then they hold 100 for people who show up. So if you show up early enough, even if it's sold out online, you might still be able to get in. So I went.
So this road show, do they have like carny folk and stuff? Because I don't know what this means. What is road show?
Well, this will be interesting when we talk about the movie, because I don't know which version of it you saw. There's the 70 millimeter projected version of it with the overture in the beginning and an intermission.
Yeah, I didn't get that.
You didn't get that. You saw the regular one.
Yeah.
Well, we'll see how that affects the review, because I have no idea what was, other than the intermission and the overture, I have no idea content-wise what's the difference between the two. And I know there's, like, I think 15 extra minutes of footage somewhere.
It's going to be interesting if that's true and there is a big difference and we're like, what are you talking about? You're a crazy asshole.
Well, let's go ahead and get on with the episode then. Because we're going to be reviewing Tarantino's eighth film, arguably eighth film, The Hateful Eight, we're going to forego the news segment, mostly because there isn't any. And we're going to talk a little bit about his other films preceding this one. We've done this a few times before, these director profiles. We did one on Fincher somewhat recently when Gone Girl came out. We did another one on Kevin Smith when Tusk came out. So I kind of wanted to do something along those lines with Tarantino, because I think we were both surprised that we hadn't already.
Yeah. We did it for Moonrise Kingdom.
Oh, yeah. Wes Anderson.
There we go, yeah.
And he had a lot of movies, too. That was a...
That was a track, yeah.
It was. But let's go ahead and start with first impressions. You said something that kind of I thought was funny before we started rolling on the show. You said he was like the bros art house director.
Well, I mean, okay, so I'm sure, I know you do this. We've had this like post and like pre-show talk. We look at our audience. Like I always look at the audience when I see a movie. For whatever reason, I have to know who, you know, The Big Short, geriatric movie.
Yeah.
Like, seriously.
The snowballs. Yeah.
Yeah. This movie looked like I was at a football game. There was so much Oregon Ducks and all that kind of. Even the girls coming in, they were like bros. They were dressed kind of dude-like. And so it was kind of like, okay, got it. But yeah, no, I mean, I still think that that's kind of still true-ish.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he has lots of, you know, he has lots of influences, but I think he's a little bit more palatable for, I guess, your everyday person. I feel so fancy saying that. Put on my fancy shoes.
I would say that you're not wrong in that assessment. I think that he does. I don't know. Tarantino is an interesting person for a lot of reasons. And he's one of those people. If you want to whittle it down a little bit more, I think that's if you consider yourself a critic in any way, shape, or form, or somebody who, you know, totes himself as a film buff, you sort of have to reckon with Tarantino. You know,
sure.
At some point, somebody asked you, you know, and Tarantino's even said this in interviews that you know, you can almost kind of, you know, this is a very Tarantinian kind of thing to say because he's has no problem with tooting his own horn, but he, you know, he said that you can almost kind of split what kind of critic a critic is based upon whether they do or don't like his movies. And that's kind of true to some extent. You know, I think that he's, for a lot of people, sort of the poster child for postmodernism in popular filmmaking. And the way that he combines his influences and sort of has this like hip hop approach or sampling approach from, I'll take a little bit from this director here, a little bit from that director there. Recently there was a side by side, shot composite, YouTube video that showed like all of the direct shots that he lifted from other movies throughout his career. And it's, you know, he clearly knows what he's doing. It's not stealing in the sense that he's like, oh, I'll do this and nobody will know. Like, it's
he uses it to kind of inform the work too,
right?
In a way,
he's still sort of talking about film as a cultural landmark as he's kind of telling his own narratives. There's kind of the dual narrative in all of his movies. There's the story of the movie, which is, you know, whatever it may be. In the case of Reservoir Dogs, it's like a heist film, or in the case of Jackie Brown, it's kind of like a heist film. Or whatever, you know, Kill Bill revenge movie, Western, whatever it may be, that's the story. But then there's also the sort of extra textual thing of what is he saying about the genre? And there's almost kind of in a...
Well, he definitely plays with genre too. Like, I mean, and he does it in a purposeful way that he goes, you know, I know this is the way it's been shown and been done, and I'm going to do it a little bit different in this way, or maybe this is an interesting way to look at it. So, yeah. And you can't really say that he hasn't influenced film. I mean, he has.
Yeah.
I can almost kind of get why like certain critics wouldn't like him.
Mm-hmm.
And even just for the gratuitous violence, he's kind of sidelined. Like, I mean, sometimes his movies, I'm like, yeah, they definitely have a subtext. And then sometimes I'm like, it seems like somebody who kind of doesn't completely understand subtext, but does subtext. And I'm kind of like that. So maybe that's
right.
Part of the problem. But,
Well, I've also heard him say that he tries not to think too much about subtext.
But I think you have to do that. Like, I mean, honestly.
Right.
Because I think if you start thinking about your subtext too much, then you basically, I mean, I don't think you can make a cohesion, like, thing if you don't go, okay, but this is the story. This is the real story and what the story needs to tell.
Right. And it has to work ultimately as a story. You can't just be Mr. Clever and, you know, just throw in all of this metatextual stuff that, I mean, you can do that to a point, but somewhere in there, you still have to have a movie. If you're that kind of director, if you're making pop filmmaking, which is what Tarantino wants to do, he's not just making experimental,
right,
you know, film essays like a Godard's last 20 years of work.
Right, 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 right. No, he's making something that's trying to be accessible and trying to, I mean, ultimately, I think movies are for a broader audience. So I think that he does it in a way that satisfies, I mean, it satisfies him, but it satisfies a certain market. But I think it's good because, I mean, it also says, like, it doesn't have to just be, you know, a revenge movie. It can be something bigger than that. Like, so, I mean, just to have somebody to challenge that is good.
Yeah, and I think that culture on a large scale has kind of caught up with him. I think, you know, what he was doing when he first started out with Reservoir Dogs and Pulp Fiction was kind of seen as sort of outsider and kind of niche-y and kind of weirdo art expression sort of stuff. And now, because he's been ripped off so shamelessly, and to much lesser degrees, over the, you know, past 20 years of film, his stuff seems to be, you know, sit pretty well right there in the middle of the multiplex, mm-hmm, in a way that, like, Pulp Fiction, when it came out, it was a big art hit and people, you know, filmy people really liked it and talked a lot about it, but it was still kind of sort of a cult film. Let's go ahead and get into it then, now that we've kind of preambled a little bit on it. And Reservoir Dogs came out in 1992, sort of his calling card. Not the first screenplay he ever wrote. He actually wrote his screenplay for True Romance and Natural Born Killers, and sold those to actually fund, in part, pre-production for Reservoir Dogs, which he wanted to do as his first film. Some people have seen it as a... American remake, essentially, of a Hong Kong film called City on Fire, though he's always denied that was his main inspiration. What do you have to say about Reservoir Dogs?
I mean, it's kind of hard. This film, I mean, I've always liked this film. I kind of bounce between what's my favorite, what's his best, and there's a lot of questions with Tarantino for me.
Yeah, well, you don't have to think about it in terms of ranking, yeah, just in general.
Right, right, right. No, I know. But this film specifically, I mean, I this kind of shows you the where he's going kind of thing.
Yeah.
And it's really those character interactions and those character, just how they interact and how they change the world and how they kind of go out from there. You know, he says he can always tell, going back to him being self-aware and kind of weird about it. He says, you know, I can always tell what kind of person somebody is by the character they like in my movies.
That's
and
true.
I mean, I obviously think he's a really bad man, but I always like Mr. Blonde's character in there.
Yeah.
He's unassuming. He's fucking. And then when that scene hits, it's frightening and it turns the corner really, really quick. I mean, mm-hmm. he built suspense in it's a small room, essentially. I mean, you break out of it a little bit, but it's
a chamber piece.
Yeah. It's a chamber piece. And so I've always really liked Reservoir Dogs. It's usually one of my favorites of his. I have a weird time because that always changes with his movies.
Yeah, me too. But I think Reservoir Dogs is always in my top three. And I think it's such a calling card. Like, it's such a stylistic hurrah. Like, you know, it just, there's no timid filmmaking in this. I mean, it's low budget. Mm. I think, you know, probably made for $1.5 million or something like that, maybe $2 million. This was like the early days of independent film. You know, it almost didn't get made at all, except for the fact that Harvey Keitel signed on early and brought a lot of legitimacy to it and a lot of attention to get it made. Like, the influences are clear. He clearly loves 70s filmmaking. He clearly loves filmmakers like Martin Scorsese, like Brian De Palma, and that kind of era of, like, the film brats, boys club sort of tough male movies. But he brings, you know, this kind of ironic 90s Gen Xer quality to it. One of the things I think is really funny about Reservoir Dogs, the first line ever spoken in a Tarantino film, like, this is how he introduces himself to the world. This is his first impression to the world, is, let me tell you what Like a Virgin's about. Like a Virgin's about a girl who likes a guy with a big dick. That's the first line that he introduced the world to what he is about as a filmmaker.
And he also said those lines.
He delivered the line, yes. it's a really good film. It takes a lot of wild turns. Introduced this very interesting thing that he's a very formally interested director. And so his first films especially really mess around with the timeline, jumping back and forth. And he's able to hold suspense in really interesting ways by doing that. With what would normally be very formulaic kind of genre stuff, by messing around with the timeline, that's a lot of the reason why people call him a postmodern filmmaker, besides the fact that he's very referential. The fact that he messes around with the timeline really kind of turns all those genre conventions on their ear. No pun intended.
Right. And the postmodern is, I mean, you're mostly just talking about like things that are referential and things that kind of like, they're after the modern period, and they're, am I getting that right? Just making
sure. Right. Well, I mean, you know, it's a combination of a lot of things. People define postmodernism in part by having a clear frame of reference for, the work that comes before them and making reference to it. But then there's also, like, some people have said that postmodernism is defined by chronology and the fact that he messes around with chronology and the fractures times or fractures characters and that kind of stuff sort of defines postmodernism to a certain extent as well.
So that's the down and dirty version. Okay.
Yeah. I mean, it's a multi-stranded kind of theory, but he seems to fit a lot of versions of it. And going into off of that, Pulp Fiction, we're going to skip True Romance because that was technically not directed by him. And
right. I figured we would.
For time's sake, I recommend it. It's a great little film, but his next film, his jumping off point from, you know, what was seen as a Sundance hit with Reservoir Dogs, ended up becoming a generation defining film in Pulp Fiction. We've already talked a decent amount about it.
Oh yeah. I mean, Pulp Fiction, we talked a little bit about it before. Like, I remember watching it the first time.
Yeah.
Like, and there's not necessarily a whole lot of films I remember from my, like, being very young watching and remembering the exact viewing moment and stuff like that, even where I was at the time I was viewing it. And it is one of those films because it is very, it's just very memorable in the stories it's telling. And again, it's those character interactions. It's the way that they talk to each other. And this is a film that I always have a hard time placing personally.
Yeah.
I always have a lot of respect and I always really like it, but sometimes I feel like it's very loose compared to some of his other films. I feel like there's a lot of strands and I don't feel like all of them tie not even tie up, because that's not really what it's interested in. But what I'm saying is sometimes I think this was 4 or 5 years ago. I asked you, well, what is that film about? And you said it's about salvation. It's about, people redeeming themselves.
Right. And, that's a major theme that repeats.
Not religious salvation.
Yeah. One of the major things about the film is that it takes all of these, pulp fiction. It takes all of these kind of noirish, exploitation, spaghetti Western tropes. And, a lot of what the movie does and why it's fun to watch is it tells you these characters are this thing. And then by the end of their vignettes, because it's a series of three short vignettes that kind of interweave. By the end of the vignette, you're told, oh, no, this character is actually something else.
No. And I remember watching this film and being very something else he does that I think sometimes people don't, maybe they do tout, but it doesn't seem like I hear a lot about, is how well he showcases actors' abilities. This is a film where I was like, oh, first of all, he resurrected John Travolta at the time, but then also Samuel Jackson. This is basically this is one of his big starting roles.
Yeah.
That really started him off in Hollywood.
In a big way. He'd been in several smaller parts in movies, like Spike Lee, Do the Right Thing, and he was in Jurassic Park and, a very
hold on to your butts.
Right. And a very small part in Goodfellas. But this was a big showcase where he got to, he kind of stole the show. And in a movie where there's a lot of great performances.
Right. And so, that's kind of my takeaway from Pulp Fiction. This is a film I don't feel like I have a really good, I've always really enjoyed it, but I don't always feel like I have a really good, take on it or whatever you want to say, or even really, I just watch it, I enjoy it, and I think it's good. And that's all I really know about it. So.
Right. Well, like a lot of his films, I think it's, and maybe even more explicitly because it's not one narrative, it seems like a celebration of cinema in a big way. And actually what's funny is we take the structure of it for granted now, again, because it's been ripped off so much.
Sure.
But also because, you think of Pulp Fiction, it is what it is. It's just, that's Pulp Fiction. It's that movie with three stories and, they're cool and whatever. But when Tarantino was making the movie, he was actually kind of nervous about it. And he wasn't crazy about the final cut of the movie. Probably the only time in his life, had some butterflies about releasing it and how it was going to come off. He said to Robert Rodriguez, who was kind of his compadre at the time, or still is, who was one of the only people who saw it early, he's like, yeah, I'm not sure if it's a movie. I like parts of it. I don't know what people are going to think. And then it ended up becoming what it's become. And sure, it has always had its detractors. But almost no movie defines the 90s more completely than that film. And there's a real dividing line between how genre film has been approached before and after the release of it.
No, I think it's anybody who talks about, oh, well, there's no good films in the 90s, the first thing that they ever say, well, what about Quentin Tarantino? The whole explosion of the independent, that's a huge thing. But he is one of the biggest names and one of the only big names in the modern period, I think.
Well, there's a lot that have kind of graduated with him up in that league. And we've seen them all kind of win their Oscars and, graduated from small, indie art house rebels to becoming, the prestige of the modern age. But, and certainly he's joined that crowd. In fact, he won Best Original Screenplay, which a lot of people don't realize this or don't like to remember it, but this was actually co-written by Roger Avery, who would later go on to direct the film Rules of Attraction, based on the Bret Easton Ellis novel, which has like very kind of Pulp Fiction-y structure. It was one of many Pulp Fiction ripoffs. So
that I remember nothing about it. So
it was like Pulp Fiction that took place on a college campus with a bunch of spoiled, rich campus kids who all behave like Patrick Bateman.
That's good. That sounds good.
I actually recommend it. It's not a likable film, but it's kind of groovy for what it is.
Groovy. I like that. ER? Should we talk about now?
he started writing television. Well, I did do a lot of stuff, but Jackie Brown is a really interesting film, and maybe for a lot of reasons, it's rarely people's favorite films unless it is definitely their favorite film.
Sure.
But in a lot of ways, I think it is one of the most interesting films of his to talk about, which I think is why there's been this modern renaissance of people touting it as his best or his unsung or.
Oh, I'm in that crowd. I think it is his best film. It's not my favorite of his films. It's not his most enjoyable film, but I think that it is his best film. By that, what I'm saying is I think the way that, everything that he's usually known for, like that fast, that energy, everything like that, it's all controlled, it's all turned down, it's all muted, but everything you love about Quentin Tarantino is still there.
Right.
I think that this one really does kind of bring up the, I think when you talk about some of his, him knowing critique and him knowing a lot about that world.
Yeah.
I think that this film shows a lot of, you know, feministic and color kind of criticism kind of ideas in it. And right. I think in an interesting way.
Well, it's interesting that it's making reference both in its title and by the marketing campaign behind it. And, you know, it's making reference to blaxploitation films. Now,
right.
Pulp Fiction, Reservoir Dogs had bits of that. Specifically, the character of Jules is very much sort of a blaxploitation throwback. But in this film, you know, one of the more fascinating things about it is that it's based upon the Elmore Leonard novel. I think it was called Rum Punch, which the original characters, most of the characters were white, including the lead character. It was like a middle-aged white lady from Florida. And he changes a few things. I think he keeps the basic structure of the story the same, but he moves it from Florida to South Central LA. And, you know, you look at most of the locations, it's like Linwood and Compton and, in all these South Bay areas, which is sort of where he grew up. And, you know, we're talking the mid-90s. So all of those areas were kind of known for something else at that time, because that was like the height of like gangster rap and like, you know, it was sort of highlighted in the media as being a certain place where violence and racial inequality and all of this stuff sort of came from. Again, this is a lot of the subtext I'm not sure if he knows he's doing, but to make a blaxploitation film or like a throwback to it, and then to treat the characters like they're real people, not exploitable objects or, you know, just trying to create these stories that for lurid fantasies or whatever, like a lot of old blaxploitation films, he actually treats these characters that in a blaxploitation film as if they're real people.
Well, I mean, also casting Pam Grier,
who
has a history of being in black exploitation and actually really, I see, to me, it's like one of her characters grown up. What happens 30 years down the line for one of her characters? And it completely works. But at the same time, I don't know if it really matters if a director knows what he's doing or not. If it's there, it's there.
Well, subtextually, yeah.
Yeah, subtextually. And I think in this case, whether he knew or didn't know, I think is unimportant. What I think is that it is very interesting.
It makes an interesting political point, yeah.
Well, all of the characters are stacked against Jackie. And she has to basically outwit and outmaneuver all of them. And she does. Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, especially now in a very, you know, I don't really feel either direction. I feel very strange about it. But with the PC kind of like politics that kind of get thrown around right now, like it's much more interesting than any of the post that this kind of newer era really talks about. I think that it's a very interesting film when we're kind of talking about, mm-hmm. you know, having strong female characters, having strong black characters. This has both.
Mm-hmm.
and they're real people. They're interesting and they're written well.
Right. I would agree with you. And also, I think you mentioned it a little bit, that it shows a certain amount of restraint.
Yeah.
You know, he can do the big set pieces and he can do the big splatter fests and he loves cinema and sometimes he can be very kind of, loud about his appreciation of the genre and doing certain things and wanting to jump to the first chance to do a big set piece or that kind of stuff. And this movie has a different kind of energy to it. It's a lot more laid back. It's a lot more pulled back. And, you know, he likes to brag that, he made a film that a director in his 50s would make when he was still in his 30s.
Mm-hmm.
And I have mixed feelings about his bragging as far as that goes. But yeah, you watch this movie and it almost seems, you know, people have used the word autumnal to describe the tone of that movie. And, you know, it's largely about people in their autumn years and looking back and regret and da da da. But it's an interesting film. And I think it's one that a lot of people our age and younger have still never seen or have skipped over.
Well, I think it's one that's hard because I think the first time you see it, I don't think it actually...
It's impossible. It's almost, especially if yeah. you've seen his other work, it's almost impossible to love that movie first. It's like his Vertigo.
Well, yeah, there's a lot of things happening. It's very slow. It doesn't have those little things that you're like, it doesn't have that energy that his other films would have.
Right.
And that you would expect to
have. It's not as punk rock.
So, it's not that rock and roll quality that we've talked about. And honestly, that's okay. It's just, I don't think it's going to appeal to certain people. Because I don't think that they'll give it a second chance. But if you give it a second chance, it really does some of those comedic pulls. Like there's some stuff with Robert De Niro that just kill me every time.
No, yeah, it's one of those movies where after you've seen it the one time and you get what the story is, mm-hmm. kind of Big Lebowski is sort of this way too. Like you're kind of so caught up in like, well, where is Bunny Lebowski? Did she do it? Da da da. And you have a hard time actually appreciating the comedy. But
right.
the second time you see it, or the second time you see Jackie Brown, you start to just, and the third and fourth and fifth and however many times you go back to it, you start to just pull out these interesting, fun little details. I get a kick out of how everybody really loves the black suit she's going to buy when she's like, it's just, you know, a MacGuffin for how they're going to get away with this setup. But mm-hmm. like every time people see her in the black suit, they're like, oh, damn, that looks good on you.
Right.
Okay, let's move on. He took a break. He took a long break between Jackie Brown, which came out in 1997, and Kill Bill Volume 1, which was kind of his big comeback film in 2003. He had a hard time coming up with a screenplay. I think he was already starting Inglourious Basterds and was kind of stuck in the muck.
Well, I mean, you could hypothesize. I don't know if it's true or not, but he... You know, I know that people didn't feel, I think he wanted people to have a better opinion of Jackie Brown when it first came out.
Yeah, it took time.
Than they did. And I think that he might have, you know, maybe it took a, because I kind of think that, again, I think that sometimes when you take away that, like, if you give somebody fear, who, you know, needs to have no fear when they produce,
yeah.
I think sometimes that can kind of get in the way of the process.
Yeah, and it took a few years or even a few decades for people to really appreciate Jackie Brown. But Kill Bill Volume 1 is, you know, stylistically about as opposite as you can get. And we'll talk about Kill Bill in
right.
tandem. We don't have to split them in two. They are kind of different. Kill Bill Volume 1 is a little bit more of a throwback to like Japanese and Hong Kong film and like Chop Saki, Shaw Brothers stuff.
Well,
whereas Volume 2 is a little bit more spaghetti Western.
Well, I've also heard that another way I've heard it said is that Volume 1 is a Western done as like a Kung Fu film.
Mm-hmm.
And that Volume 2 is a samurai film done as a Western.
Yeah. It's all in there.
Agreed. I just, for whatever reason, I do not respond to Kill Bill Volume 1. I don't really, I don't know what it is about the film. I think it's decent or whatever. It's fun to watch that like first time, and then I pretty much every time I've gone back to it, I'm like, I kind of think this is kind of boring. It's just kind of it's a popcorn film. It's like a lot of exploitation films I've seen. Like, I mean, honestly, like it's just something that I could kind of eat and throw away. Whereas the second one, for whatever reason, does appeal to me more. And every time I watch that, I was like, no, maybe I do like these Kill Bill films. But then I watch the first one and then the second one again. And it's like, oh, so it's just this weird yin and yang kind of quality for me of this film, Kill Bill Volume 1 and 2. I just, for whatever reason, do not respond to the first one as well as I do the second one.
Yeah, I think it's one of those things. It's like, you could say this about a lot of things. You know, you could tell a person by what character they like in one of his movies. You can tell a lot of person. If somebody says their favorite Tarantino film is Jackie Brown, then you definitely know what kind of person they are. Yeah. I think you can kind of say the same thing about Kill Bill Volume 1 and 2 as far as which one you like more. You know, I do think Volume 2 is a little bit more a little bit more pulled back and a little bit more thoughtful and sort of deconstructs the pop energy of the first one. I sort of like both for what they're both doing. I think I like the fact that Kill Bill Volume 1, yeah, might not be his deepest film, or especially coming off of Jackie Brown, and it might not be his most, it's definitely one of his more surfacey events, but I also think that, you know, just as a explosion of cinema, just as a, you know, a joy of orgiastic swordplay, violence for the sake thereof, you know, going much more ambitiously as far as like his cinematic approach to camera, to action, you know, this is maybe even to date between the two movies, his most ambitious film, on a technical level.
On a technical level, I was like, but okay, keep going.
And I think it has good enough stories and good enough performances to carry you through mindless violence and exploitation.
For me, that should be like, oh yeah, I should really like this film. I don't know what it is about it. It just doesn't bring me in I don't feel brought in like I do some of his other films. I don't connect to the characters like I do in his other films, in this film series. In the second one, I do a little bit more. And I think it does come down to that for me with his films, is whether I connect to those characters or not.
Yeah.
Because this is one of, I think, two of his films that I'm not crazy about.
Yeah.
But again, I do really like Volume 2. But these are like, I think Kill Bill Volume 1 and 2 are the only Quentin Tarantino movies I do not own. And truthfully, I've thought about just buying the second one, but then that feels weird to me.
Yeah, so, for completeness sake, you gotta have the first one. I'm still waiting for The Whole Bloody Affair to come out on Blu-ray.
Mm-hmm.
I have the DVDs. But yeah, that's, you know, for my own weird fetishy film collector thing, that's what I want, is I want that Whole Bloody Affair Blu-ray. And I'll probably still keep the DVDs to have the theatrical cuts.
Moving on to Death Proof, or do we have more?
No, I that's pretty much all I have to say about Kill Bill Volume 1 and 2. They're fun.
Okay.
I enjoy them. I think as pop filmmaking goes, it is his poppiest, and, you know, I would say, like, especially for younger viewers, even though as violent as they are, it's weird to say that. But for younger viewers, like, you know, between 12 and 15 is a good starting point. But let's go ahead and get into Death Proof, even though this was released as the two-part grindhouse experience. Some might say one of the more indulgent ideas he's ever had, and it did not pay off. This is probably the only one of his movies you could call an all-and-out flop. It opened, I think, third place on an Easter weekend. it's a short film, because it was released as two movies, Planet Terror, directed by Robert Rodriguez, and then Death Proof following it. So it's only like 80 minutes, and it's an explicit reference to the exploitation cinema of the 70s. Of course, the dialogue is a lot better than you get in an exploitation film, and the car chase is maybe a little bit more ambitious as far as the way it's directed, and certainly there's probably a more careful use of budget. But
well,
it is
even the storytelling. Like, I was like, there's not like those weird, like,
yeah,
because with a lot of exploitation, you get these weird, like, off scenes where it's like, this shouldn't be in the movie, but I kind of enjoy them because they shouldn't be there, but you're just seeing this little extra tidbit. And
well, some
Death
might
Proof
argue
was very, very cut.
Some might argue that there's a lot of cuttable stuff in Death Proof.
Oh, well, I think if you cut it too much, it won't be much more of a film.
Well, it's an 80-minute film. It has an interesting structure, again, going back to his formal execution of movies. It's like a weird two-act where you have this one set of girls who are kind of knocked off by this crazy stunt driver played by Kurt Russell. And then in the second half, you're introduced to a new group of girls, kind of in a Hitchcockian sort of psycho, what do I call it? The protagonist switch kind of idea.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, the same event is kind of played out again, but with different results. I enjoy it. It's an interesting film for me for this reason. When I'm in a theater and I've watched it, the first time I went and saw it, I was all in, you know, coming off the high of the Kill Bill movies and, you know, really still being super into Tarantino. I went and watched this in the theater and was just like, bad fucking ass. Like, that was, you know, probably drove a little too fast going home, that kind of thing. Then I bought it later on DVD and saw it about 2 or 3 years later and watched it on DVD and I was like, huh, doesn't work as well as I remember it. Kind of boring even until that car chase. And some of these performances are a little too hungry and maybe a little miscast. And so I had this weird idea of what the movie was where I was like, yeah, it's not as best, da da da. And then I saw it again in my cult cinema class here just recently.
Sure.
On the big screen in the Foligno Theater, and it totally worked for me again. So this movie, I think, needs to be seen in a theater.
Like, there's just a certain... Yeah, no, there's a cinematic, like, experience that I think sometimes people don't realize.
Uh-huh.
Like it has that effect. Like, there's a lot of films, like, I know and I love, and I've watched them a billion times at home. Then I go see them at theaters and I go, holy shit, this is what they were trying to do. And I've never seen it like that before because I'm in a theater. I see it. John Carpenter's The Thing.
Yeah.
That first opening shot, I never got how secluded he wanted you to feel until I saw it in theater. I was all like, oh, we're in the middle of fucking nowhere. Okay, got it. I have no idea why, but it just that size is something that sometimes you need. And this is appropriate talking about that with Tarantino because he's all about that. But a Death Proof, I don't have anything to add to it. It's a little exploitation silly thing.
Yeah.
It happened. I thought it was kind of fun. I don't remember anything about it. I saw it once DVD. Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. I think like the car chase, obviously everyone is, even people who don't like this movie can admit that that part's pretty cool.
Is that the people like on the roof and stuff like that.
Yeah, Zoe Bell, the stunt actress, she's like hanging on the roof while they're having a 90-mile-an-hour car chase.
True.
Down like these side roads in California. And I like the soundtrack a lot. It has a really cool kind of like 60s pop rock soundtrack. Some of the performances, I actually think like the first cast, like, you know, before they do the protagonist switch, I actually think like that cast is a lot more believable and a lot more, even though they're kind of terrible people, I actually was kind of like digging them a lot more than when the protagonist switch happens and then you get the more famous cast of Rosario Dawson and Zoe Bell and Mary Elizabeth Winstead in the second cast.
I do like Rosario Dawson, though.
Yeah, I mean, she's great, but it was something about her in that movie, just she seemed a little too hungry for it. Like, I don't know. It's a weird thing.
Like, she got to work with Quentin Tarantino.
Well, who doesn't want to do that? But yeah, I don't know. Something, I think the more unknown cast of the first one, I felt a little bit more entrenched in that world.
Right.
But it's whatever. It's fine.
Yeah. Now, the next film in his, like, oeuvre, The Inglourious Basterds, I have a particular take on this film, and so I think it's one of his best films. I really do.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people give me shit for it, but it is. It always stays within my top three for me.
Uh-huh.
I particularly think that it really it's talking more about the dialogue about Nazis than it is, you know, and about how the reputation was destroyed, than it is actually about World War II, because it's not about World War II at all.
No.
And I don't mean, like, I don't mean he's, like, trying to say, like, you know, portray them in a positive light, because I don't think that's what he's saying either. But what I'm saying is it's very much more on a, like, social level, on a macro level, that he's talking about World War II and how film talks about Nazis. You know, they're the best bad guys. Everybody knows that.
Yeah.
And I think that that's what kind of the film's about. I will admit, because some people like are like, well, what about this? And I'm like, I don't know. I don't know if I've ever looked at it that closely, but I think that it's a damn good film. I think it easily holds up in his film. And it's kind of his turnaround point from the Kill Bill kind of era, where he's kind of doing these weird history and different kind of genre pieces.
Yeah.
And so I think this is his first one to kind of like take aim at World War II. And he does, of course, do bring his exploitation. It's literally, the name comes from an exploitation.
An Italian film, yeah.
Yeah. And I think some of the performances, are funny as hell. I think Brad Pitt is great in it.
Mm-hmm.
I always remember his character. We also first get our first like real taste of like Michael Fassbender and
Christoph Waltz.
Yeah, that's his name.
Yeah.
I was going to say the little German fellow, but I thought that might have been. But I mean, I feel like this film kind of actually is a little underrated in his film like
catalog.
His film catalog, and I think it's one of his better ones. I think it's one that I think we'll appreciate as years go on.
Yeah, I think there. I have a kind of a mixed feelings about Inglourious Basterds and kind of the rest of his films since. And I think that there is, he's reaching past what I think he expects from himself or what other people expect from him. Mm-hmm. I think there is an ambition there in storytelling, especially, you know, there's some of his best set pieces he's ever directed to date are in this film. The tavern scene,
right,
is one of the most suspenseful set pieces he's ever been able to do. The opening sequence is terrific. You know, there's lots of interesting film homage going on, as you would expect from him. There's a really big variety of cast. I think in places it feels a little indulgent, and I think that's a little too long sometimes, and I think that there's some bits of it that feel like it kind of hangs off in a shaggy sort of way. And I don't know. It's hard for me to love it. Even though, like, when I get to those places in the film, I'm like, God, this is just transcendent. It's amazing. And then there's kind of a sloggy bit for a while. And I don't know. It's a strange film. And I think it's kind of strange for good reasons.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the overall takeaway of it is, it's bulky and kind of messy, but it is definitely worth watching, and stands among his best.
Well, one thing that I really love is the ending. And if you haven't seen the film, seriously, it's like 10 years old. Like, it's not my fault. Like, if this gets spoiled for you, but when they alter history and they kill Hitler,
right,
and in the theater, and how they do it, it's to me that I loved it.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the reasons I loved it was because like, I love that reaction of, like, everybody, what? You can't kill Hitler? Why could you do that? And to me, it's like, no. It's not saying, like, the actual historical, because none of this happened. Like,
right.
Nothing you're looking at in this movie, it's all fictional. It's all bullshit. And, you know, we all, as a, you know, we can sit down and watch an Indiana Jones film and be like, yeah. But then it comes to, you know, actually, like, sitting down and killing Hitler, then people are like, wait a second, everybody, that didn't actually happen. And it's like, oh, okay, I'm sorry. So I don't know. I think that this has a lot of quality. I don't think it's necessarily, I think it is almost kind of a return to kind of almost like Pulp Fiction-y kind of way. And it is looser. I certainly don't think it's as tight as like Jackie Brown or even Reservoir Dogs. But I for some reason really respond to this film. I think that it, and I do think that the text, I haven't seen it for a little bit, but I do think that the text literally does like say, like, look, this is what I'm saying. I'm saying something. And I think that it does have a very strong subtext. And I think it's one of his films that I think is doing that more so than any other of his films.
Right. The subtext about how film treats Nazis as a fictional villain.
Yeah. And literally, you know, and not just that, it's also, I mean, because you get all these different parts introduced, you get all these different, like the English and the German and, you know, and the Americans and everything like that. You kind of actually, with all of them, you get kind of a filmic version of them versus a realistic version of them.
Well, in a way, the film is sort of about globalism.
Right.
Which, again, would pull in his postmodern interests.
And I think that a lot of that is there. And I think in a filmic sense, it is literally saying, like, the film, more than anything, has destroyed... has destroyed, you know, Nazism. And that's not a bad thing by any means. And I mean, even that post seeing the denouement of the film where Brad Pitt's cutting into Christopher Waltz's face, which is very, very grim.
Yeah.
And kind of hard to watch. It all informs back to those points. And I think it's a great film.
Yeah. I mean, I would agree with you. Like I said, it's hard for me to love.
Well, what I noticed about your kind of opinion, and I didn't really realize this, but you have a very strong opinion and have put a lot of thought into Quentin Tarantino. But with this film, you always go back and forth how you feel about it.
Yeah, I mean...
And it's not bad. It's just... I feel like every time this film gets brought up, you say it kind of in a different way. And it's not bad. I think it's good when you wrestle with a film.
Well, this kind of goes into the next film really well, transitions to the next film really well, because I think one of the reasons I have a harder time with Inglourious Basterds is because Django Unchained does a lot of similar things and does it almost always wrong.
I don't disagree with you.
And it made me question what worked in Inglourious Basterds in kind of a bad way. I know that the film should stand on their own, and they do, but when you are looking at his body of work and you're looking at how he approaches his fetishes, Django Unchained is by far one of his most fetishistic movies and deals with that revisionist history stuff in kind of a flippant and sort of uneasy way. And there's stuff to admire about the movie. It has really good performances. I think you know, Leonardo DiCaprio is the villain of this, like, plantation owner, and Christoph Waltz, again, gives another good performance, and Samuel Jackson gives one of his best performances career-wise, but a lot of it, you know, a lot of the stuff in here about it being a hero's journey and being a traditional spaghetti western and how that mixes with the revisionist history stuff, I think clangs rather than harmonizes.
See, I think that's actually... I think it's that, the hero's journey, I do not think works here.
No.
I don't attach myself either to Jamie Foxx. And again, this is the other film that I was talking about when I was talking about Kill Bill. This is another one of his films that I could not get into. I couldn't attach to the characters, and I couldn't really see my way through it. And I think, just kind of having this conversation, I think that that's crucial to you liking his films. Whatever film he has, You have to like his characters or you will not like it. Something that I always have a weird time with this movie is because I was hearing a lot of the, like, news about it and who they were casting and stuff like that. And Will Smith was the actor that they were trying to get for Django originally. And that was the person they wanted. I feel like that would have changed this movie drastically, and I think it would have worked better. I think that it does. I don't think it completely comes down to casting, but I think that it is a crucial part for this film. And I think it is. I don't think Jamie Foxx sold it.
Well, I don't think that Jamie Foxx has the charisma quite that Will Smith has.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that Will Smith's film history would have added a different angle to how we look at that character. I still think it's a really boringly written character.
We've seen the one we're talking about, Joseph Campbellian, the one that kind of a journey, the hero's journey. We've seen that a billion times, and to be honest, that's one of the reasons I don't like the film. I start liking the film when you get introduced to the villains, when you start getting, when you get introduced to Leonardo DiCaprio and Samuel L. Jackson and right. that whole piece, I was way more intrigued by that than I was, you know, I always disagreed. I thought Christopher Waltz was kind of odd too. I thought that he was really trying and really trying to grit his teeth into it. And I don't feel like it worked. I feel like that whole like first part of the movie was kind of a slog. This is easily my least favorite of his films.
Oh, me too.
I know there are people who really liked it. I think it's kind of boring.
I don't think it's a bad movie, or maybe it is, but
I think for Quentin Tarantino, it's a bad
movie. Yeah. If you're grading on his curve, I think it's a pretty bad movie. But if you're looking at, you know, if you're grading it on the curve of like, you know,
It versus Transformers.
Sure. Right, or any other thing you're going to pick up in the action section or, you know, whatever. It has those stylistic flourishes. It has those bits of good dialogue. It has those great performances here or there. You know, it looks pretty nice. He really gets into sort of the Western vistas and all of that stuff. I just think the movie is so tonally all over the place and kind of inappropriate and vaguely offensive. And I don't know. I'm just, like, not super into it. And the longer I've been away from it, the less into it I am. I even bought it on Blu-ray and this almost has never happened to me before, even with some of my lesser Tarantino stuff. I couldn't finish it on Blu-ray. I started it, was like, oh, this is going to be so much fun. And then like got about like halfway through, and it's like, I'm kind of done. maybe I'll finish this later, and kind of never did. So I don't know.
I think what he's trying to do is interesting, and it does go back to that black exploitation. I think a lot of things he's trying with the film, I just don't think it works. I don't know if I ever thought it was offensive by any means, but it just kind of seemed kind of like, meh, kind of more shrug-worthy.
Right.
So, and again, I think it kind of comes down to, you know, the hero's journey is about the most commonplace, and I think if you're going to do it now, you have to have a pretty... Either it has to be so exciting that you forget you're watching a hero's journey,
uh-huh.
and so therefore it's just kind of just dumb popcorn entertainment, or you have to do something truly like weird with that format to even make it even stick out to anybody.
Right.
Because we're inundated with these kind of films like by
all the time. Hand. Yeah. It's not weird. The movie certainly has a lot of personality. I think it's one of his least well-written. It seems kind of rushed. I don't know. It's hard to reckon with that movie. I don't really like it all that much.
No, and I don't either. We agree on that. If I'm understanding, the reason you think it's kind of offensive is because you think that it kind of trivializes like the slave.
Right. Yeah, I think
slave kind of experience and kind of how we look at it as right. a country.
I mean, I said this in my in our review of it, our official review, and you can go back and listen to that if you're really interested. But you know, I said something to the effect that I get the feeling from the movie that it's not that he really cares about this tragedy in our history and that he really has a political point of view here, even though he swears that he does and he wanted to make a film about rights the wrongs of history and blah, 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 blah. I feel like it was all just a setup so that he could do his violent revenge fetishy stuff. Like, and because the movie does deal with kind of a real tragedy in American history, but does it in that way, it creates a ironic distance that I don't think is always appropriate, or at least not the way that it comes off.
Well, I can see how that might color your Inglourious Bastards, but I mean, from perception wise, I mean, I don't think you're wrong. One of the things I remember him saying about the film is like, he always wonders why at the end of the roots, why he didn't pick up the whip and start whipping him, you know, the other guy, right. Which I, you know, that's a very Old Testament
Right. If you're Tarantino and you grew up in the 70s watching exploitation films that were all about like, you know, these black characters, like fighting against their oppressors, they're usually directed by white people, by the way, and written. I could see like why you would have that inclination watching something like Roots. And I'm not saying that every movie dealing with racism has to be like austere and 12 Years a Slave and like really, you know.
We could get in a whole weird, because that film, if you compare Django Unchained to that film, you get into a whole other
Yeah, I mean, that there's an essay in that. There's a thesis in that.
Right.
But let's move on.
Right.
We got to eventually review his new movie, The Hateful Eight, which is his supposedly his eighth film, if you don't count True Romance and Natural Born Killers and his spit in Four Rooms or a lot of other things. But
The Hateful Eight, it stars Samuel L. Jackson, Kurt Russell. This kind of almost returns to form. It's kind of it comes back to a chamber piece.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a bit of a mystery. But it happens, and this is kind of like some of the stuff we've been talking about. Like he is playing with genre because he's doing a mystery, but as a Western. And it all takes place in this one central cabin, and you kind of come in through learning about the characters little bit by little bit, and kind of putting together pieces who they are, why they're doing what they're doing, and they're all kind of disreputable and kind of like not very good people. Is right. The best way to say it. And to be honest, I think I really did dig this one. Mm-hmm. I think Samuel L. Jackson as a lead character pulled me in. Also, Kurt Russell made me laugh a lot, and he was also kind of a lead for a little bit. So his Kurt Russell's character, John Ruth, is taking this Daisy Domahue, this character, he's taking her to hang. And he kind of picks up Walter Goggins, who is always this kind of character player who is always a delight to watch. It doesn't matter what he's in.
Yeah, he fits into the worst Tarantino world very well.
He does, but he could be in the worst film, and I would watch it for him because he's just that entertaining.
Yeah.
But basically, you start off with these three characters kind of bickering in a carriage on their way to this cabin up in the mountains. And as they head up there, kind of fighting about the politics of the time. And
right. Cause this takes place right after Civil War, and Goggins is an ex, rebel fighter.
Right.
And Samuel Jackson and sort of to some extent, Kurt Russell's character fought for the North.
Well, I think Kurt Russell is just your middle of the road white guy. I think Samuel Jackson actually like fought for the North.
Yeah.
I think John Ruth was just kind of mercenary for hire, kind of middle ground.
Yeah.
Which is kind of, it's an interesting, especially kind of with, you know, how we talk about race a lot right now. And so to have these very loaded characters, I is at least a very interesting choice.
Mm-hmm.
And basically they get up to this cabin and, a pivotal things happens and, they're trying to figure out what all the missing pieces. It basically becomes Clue.
A little bit, yeah.
Well, in the comedic style, I really felt that for whatever weird reason. But also, it had weird like splatterings of. I brought up John Carpenter's The Thing earlier, but yeah. It has weird splatterings of that and The Shining. He pulls right from The Thing. There's a scene where they're going out to the outhouse and there's those blue and white lights.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the shot, it could have been out of The Thing, straight up out of it. Also, you've got that lead-in shot that is just like The Shining. It's that long kind of winding up journey where we're getting away from civilization.
Right.
We're out on our own.
We're about to head to a bad place.
Yeah. Yeah. And to be honest, that was a cool lead-in. That drum and that, bleak. Looking into this like cross,
and one of his more purely cinematic kind of things, you know, because he's not for all the things that Tarantino does as a director, where you know he pulls in you know interesting music choices, or he'll do a quick cuts of these chop-socky things.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he likes to play with the camera, and he's a very playful director. But I wouldn't say that he's always 100% concerned with how something is framed,
mm-hmm.
more than how it feels. And this movie is, because it was shot in ultra-wide 70mm, there's a lot of, especially early on, there's a lot of composition, and there's a lot of, like, you know, letting the surroundings sort of become a character in a way that Tarantino's never really done before.
And I think in those first parts, I think the 70mm would have been really interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Once we get inside, I'm not so sure about it. I think you could have done it with digital and it would have been just fine.
Right.
I'm sorry, Quentin.
No, I agree with you there.
However, that being said, there are a lot of cool moments inside the, you know, the, I think the there's towards those later scene where Samuel L. Jackson's trying to get this old white racist to get in a gunfight with him, played by Bruce Dern. Yeah. And he and this other character, Bob the Mexican, is playing on the piano. And so
playing Silent Night.
Yes.
Well, this is a Christmas movie.
Vaguely. And it while he's playing this, he's using this very well-known song, but the way it's played, the timbre, the scene that it's in, it's weird. It establishes a strange tone, like a somber tone and kind of a dark tone, like that song, you know, can do, but it doesn't do it in the traditional way.
Yeah.
And which is also, again, sort of maybe an interesting,
playful kind of thing.
Well, I mean, I didn't think about this until right now, but tying the Silent Night into the you know, the cross at the start. I don't know if anything's there really, but it's just those pieces I'm kind of putting together.
Sure.
You also got Michael Madsen, who plays Joe Gage. He's just kind of a farmhand.
Son of a bitch. Yeah.
He's a horrible little man.
And Tim Roth, who plays kind of a British dandy, supposedly the hangman who's supposed to hang Jennifer Jason Leigh's character.
Mm-hmm. It's got a lot of moving parts, like any mystery would. And I mean, basically, that's what it's mostly interested in being.
Right. It has a Murder on the Orient Express kind of setup, like it, you know. And like you said, like the Clue almost. Like,
well, that's how I very much felt about the film. I thought I was watching the Western, and you know what, with a Quentin Tarantino flourish, which I'm not. I like Clue. I mean, if we're being honest, this is just a chamber mystery. This is what this is.
Yeah, it is. This is another film like Inglourious Basterds for me, where there's things about this movie that I love and that I appreciate the hell out of its experimental nature, how stripped back it is, how it is all contained in basically one location. You could do this movie as a stage play. And I think he even teased the idea back when he wasn't sure if he was going to make it or not.
And he still thinks he's going to. I mean, he does say that he'll start it like, you know, after chapter two, which is literally just them coming in, which could completely work. You could just strip away all of the carriage ride in. But I think that would kind of strip away some of its character. It is long. So I don't know if the intermission helped or not. But for me, I didn't feel the time without the intermission. The only thing that I guess I kind of I don't know if this happened in your version, but in my version, there's a voiceover. It's done by Quentin.
Yeah.
And I wasn't crazy about it for whatever reason. I felt like it needed a stronger voice or presence.
Right. And it could have been a time thing. It could have been like, I don't want to pay somebody famous to do this, blah, blah, blah.
Right.
Here's my issues with the movie. Like I said, there's a lot about it I really like. I like that it's experimental. I like that it's kind of stripped back and it's kind of a return to sort of a Reservoir Dogs chamber piece kind of thing. I like all of that stuff. I like the characters. I really like I won't say who it happens to, but the intermission in the Roadshow version happens after First Blood is drawn. And I like how, like, structurally that works. And then coming off the intermission, if you happen to see it in that version, but even it's still sort of a first half, second half experience, the second half of the movie goes cuckoo bananas.
Mm-hmm.
Really fast. Like, it takes a turn for the mean, and this is by far his meanest movie.
Well, talking about that, some of the effects are done very well. Mm-hmm. And if you stayed after, you could see that they were done by Greg Nicotero, which right now, I mean, besides being a big horror special effects guy, he's also been doing Walking Dead for the last 8 seasons.
Mm-hmm.
So he does big bloody effects.
There's an aspect of this movie. It is, yes, it is a kind of a comedy. It's kind of a chamber piece, like a play, but it's kind of a thriller horror film as well, and as the movie goes, it becomes even more so, and the Carpenter influence, so you start to think about The Thing a lot more once the splattering starts to occur. And unlike some parts of Inglourious Basterds and most of the parts of Django Unchained, I actually appreciated the splatter here. And it has a dark comedic effect that I sort of appreciate.
It has a theme. I think it works thematically, for sure.
Right, yeah. And the long wind-up to it is interesting. I do think, again, I saw the Roadshow version is, I think, something like 10 minutes longer than the rest. I think there's about 25 minutes that could have been cut pretty easily. Mm-hmm. I think that it's kind of overindulgent. Not even kind of. I think a lot of it is very, very overindulgent. The idea that he wanted to do a chamber piece in 70 millimeter kind of says everything about the, kind of critiques the film in itself. Things like hiring Ennio Morricone to do the score, one of the first Western scores he's done in something like 40 plus years. This is the first score Tarantino's ever used. Usually he uses source music or he grabs from old scores from other soundtracks and does his like hip hop remix thing. And this, he actually hired a composer to write him a score. And then he was given a few pieces that were, that Marconi did for the thing that he ended up not using.
Mm-hmm.
But essentially he got his own original score and yet in a few places still insists on throwing in needle drops, that don't necessarily play that well. And I think that a lot of the monologuing that happens in this movie, because everybody gets like a 10-minute monologue. There's eight characters here, and all of them get maybe a 10 or 15 monologue where they say what they're about, where they're from, what their history is, what their moral stance on everything is. And then in an episodic kind of way that's sort of interesting, but it can never become the crackling thriller it wants to be because there's so much speechifying and monologuing going on leading up to, maybe
that's because of the experience for me, because mm-hmm. there wasn't an intermission. I didn't sit on it. You know, it went straight into where more blood is drawn. This is why I had to ask you specifically who was killed. Cause I was like, oh, cause there's a scene where things really go cuckoo bananas.
Yeah.
And somebody else gets shot.
Mm-hmm.
For your purposes in our conversation, I'm talking about the crotch shot.
Right. Yeah.
And that's when it really, but to me that glided right through. It worked. It connected. Like I actually think like breaking it up would be a bad idea because you're actually taking away from your momentum and your build. What would be the point of that? You know, and if we're talking about a chamber piece and a thriller at that, you really don't want to take away from your momentum and build. I get that it's like an old Hollywood and that's what he wants, but that, it's not a thing anymore.
Well, not only is it not a thing, I'm not saying like nobody could ever do a movie with an overture and an intermission ever again, that it's right. a totally dated idea. I mean, it is a dated idea and he knows that, but I don't think it works for this movie because this movie should be a really taut thriller because at its heart, that's what it is. Structurally, that's what it is. But I think it's so overwritten mm-hmm. as far as the dialogue goes and as far as how it plays out that it never really can be that. Now,
I think I missed that from, because I don't think that happens as much in Django. I think there are certain characters that monologue, but there are some that are very monolithic and you don't really get a sense of character. Whereas in this, they were all characters.
No, yeah, you and get so, plenty. In a way, I said episodic earlier. Maybe I meant novelistic. Like, if you look at this movie, I mean, it's split into chapters, and that's something he normally does. But if you look at this like it were a book, mm-hmm. you could kind of get away with, like, really digging into the histories of the past of everybody here. But, you know, I liken it to this. In a way, this movie, yeah, there's a lot of the thing in here. There's a lot of Reservoir Dogs structurally. Mm. Even more so, it's kind of like he took that tavern scene from Inglourious Basterds and stretched it out for 3 hours. Mm. Now, the reason the tavern scene works as a thriller experience better than anything he's ever done before is because of the length that it is and where he puts it and how the characters are talking, but they're not talking about who they are. Everybody's duplicitous and everybody's, and there's that going on in this movie as well, but I don't know. I feel like the windup is so long that it, you know, the cord that's supposed to be, you know, has become a tightrope, sort of starts to sag as the hours start to duplicate.
And again, I don't know if that's maybe your experience, mm-hmm. like with the intermission and with the length and with the showmanship of the Beverly and everything like that. Yeah. I went and saw it at 16 Blux.
Yeah, you saw the theatrical cut.
Basic popcorn-like way of seeing it. And to be honest, I thought it was very entertaining and flowed quite nicely.
I'm sure it's... I could only imagine cutting anything will make it a better cut.
Mm-hmm.
I would be interested in seeing the theatrical version of the movie to see how it plays. I'll ask this. I don't know if this was something that hit the cutting room floor or not, because to me it stuck out like a sore thumb. Towards the middle of the movie, there's a flashback sequence that goes on for kind of a while. Was that all in there?
Towards the middle?
When we're introduced to...
Well, okay, to just break this, we're just going to have to break it again, Channing Tatum.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah, that was in there.
See, I thought that whole thing could have hit the cutting room floor.
I think pieces of it could, but honestly, it worked. It worked in my viewing, at first I wasn't sure about it. And I thought that, and I think maybe parts of it were cut out too. Like, honestly, because I have no idea what we're talking about at this point. Like, where that 15 minutes could have been.
There's a pretty lengthy, it's the only place that this movie cuts non-linearly.
Right.
But it goes back and explains, you know, some other details that we're supposed to know about this cabin. But,
well, coming from somebody who's really against TV for whatever reason. This is kind of a thing that happens in television a lot, where they show you the bit, and then they come back and they go, oh, but this is happening.
Right, right. I know.
And I thought that was really, to me, that was just like, oh, this is like kind of, they actually don't do this a lot anymore,
mm-hmm.
But they do it a lot in TV still. They don't do it in film a whole lot, though. And so that's something that I was like, oh, that's interesting.
Well, I also saw it as kind of a reference back to Reservoir Dogs, where we go back into Mr. Orange's story once we realize what he's all about.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that if structurally it's very similar, I just don't think it plays as well. And in large part because it's weird, like that whole part to me felt like it could have come from Django, because it's really jokey in a place in the movie where it doesn't need to be, and it's really miscast, like having Zoe Bell just randomly playing a New Zealand lady in the movie, like threw me the fuck out of the movie.
See, it didn't to me. And again, I wonder if that breath, I don't think this movie needed a breath. That's what I keep going back to. And it's not just because you're like, oh, this is going to be different. I just keep thinking about my movie experience. If right. I was interrupted halfway through this. Yeah. Well, first of all, where you're saying that cut is, where you're saying with the drawing of the first blood, and then and then having that happen like in another part, because when you break that up, you're thinking about it in two pieces.
Yeah.
I think it would be very disruptive. But in my viewing, since all of that was one piece, there's only one like little flashback. There's not another cut to it. There's not another bump. That being said, the character that shows up in this little like flashback is one of my least favorite in the movie. I think it needed his story needed to be explained so you knew what the fuck was happening, kind of.
Right.
But I think pieces could be cut, but I don't think it necessarily needed to be. I mean, the film is where it stands.
Right. I will say, in the defense of that sequence, even though I think most of it doesn't work, I think Channing Tatum's actually like pretty good. I was sort of worried about him in this movie because I've never seen him in a period piece. And
sure.
When he's not in really broad comedy, I usually am not that into him.
I thought when he was talking to Bruce Dern's character, he was really good. Before that, I wasn't really sure. That's the scene that I was like, okay, I'll be okay with him.
I thought he was actually carried himself pretty well. He actually was intimidating, which is something I didn't know he could be. And weirdly enough,
I didn't find him intimidating at all until that scene.
Well, I mean, ultimately, whatever. It worked for me, but
sure.
And kind of funnily enough, I don't know if when this occurred, if he still thought he might be Gambit at some point, because now he's not going to be. But he could have been.
Right.
He pulls off the the Creole accent actually really well. Yeah, I very similarly for me to Inglourious Basterds, I think this has a lot of his best stuff, and I think it has a lot of his worst qualities as a filmmaker getting in the way of himself.
Which some directors that happens to.
I still appreciate it for its meanness and for its commitment to the one location thing, especially. And I'd be interested in seeing the shorter cut.
Yeah, I can't really. I don't know. I don't see some of the faults as much. And again, I reacted favorably to Inglourious Basterds. So some of the things that you might be calling shaggy, I didn't see like that in Inglourious Basterds. So I wouldn't see like that in this version either. Mm. In Hateful Eight, I did like the meanness, of course. It fitted some of my fetishistic violence. I felt like it was operatic and it was big and it was to be hateful, I guess, right, you could say, in a silly way. You know, I think that these dialogues and this kind of infighting and these different like angles from it, I think to me overall played very interesting, especially, you know,
right.
And I responded to it well. I thought it was very entertaining. I can't really say anything. I think that all of the positives, mm-hmm, and all the strengths of it make up for any weaknesses there may have been. I was just very much entertained by it. Maybe on subsequent viewings, because he is a director that I go back and I watch his work.
Yeah.
Maybe I'll have a different take on it. But this first take, I was like, no, I'm down. I was into it.
See, and I actually like feel the same way, but in the opposite, in that like I'm kind of in the middle with it, but I feel like maybe watching it more and more, I could appreciate some of the waiting around and some of the stuff that I thought was a little laggy. Mm-hmm. I maybe like Jackie Brown in that way, I could pick up on the details that sort of make all of it come together.
True.
So I see it as a grower in that way. And there's so much about it that I really like. I like the fact that he doesn't like try and solve any world problems, really. He talks about a lot of political stuff in this movie, and it informs the characters in an interesting way. And of course, if you're following the news about him and Black Lives Matter and all of that stuff, it's kind of impossible not to think about that.
Mm-hmm.
Even though ultimately it doesn't have that much stake in the narrative.
Well, the narrative itself works.
Right.
If you're talking specifically about race and his political views, it is part of the overall structure of the film, but it never takes over.
It also kind of like in some ways, again, not giving anything away, it reminded me of sort of the Pulp Fiction Bruce Willis story and the unlikely partnership thing.
Yeah.
So it calls back to his work in a really interesting way.
Well, I mean, even kind of like I was thinking of like Rope a lot when I watch this film as well.
Yeah. I mean,
yeah, obviously it's a chamber piece, but just kind of the overall kind of attitude of everybody, all the right characters,
and if you're talking
and how they're talking to each other.
Right. And when you're talking about, you know, thrillers of a certain kind, Hitchcock inevitably comes up because he invented the language.
Right.
And but you know,
specifically at that film though,
yeah,
I feel like is a little bit more like,
well, that is a very stagey kind of
It has a stagey performance, but beyond that, I think that if you're like kind of explaining to somebody that has some film literacy, if you're like, well, it kind of has, because we're talking all these different things. But if you say like The Thing and The Shining and some of the other films that I've brought up, they'd be like, oh, that sounds kind of horrible. Right. But overall, I think I guess I would say like a Western violent version of Rope.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. That's as good of a description as anything. I mean, or a Western version of The Thing, or, you know, a lot of.
Well, that's almost kind of, I mean, really looking at his stuff, like, because I'm, of course, a big John Carpenter fan. Just looking at his things, he's so informed by the Western that it's hard not to see any parts of, like, the masculine masculinity and those kind of questions come up in his work.
Right.
Like, it's hard not to. So.
And there's a decent amount of Rio Bravo kind of going on in here. You know, they're not holding up a prison and defending themselves off of you know, invaders, but it has that kind of waiting aroundness quality to it. It's like, well, the shit's gonna hit the wall, we're just waiting for it to happen. And, you know, it has a big ensemble cast, and everybody, like I said, gets their moment. I think Walter Goggins is, I wasn't sure about him at first, but then I felt like he really kind of found his groove in the movie, and I really dug him. Jennifer Jason Leigh really gives, like, a very surprising, different, scary performance in this movie.
Oh, Kurt yeah, Russell, she's mean.
Yeah, she represents the craziness of the movie. Kurt Russell is doing a really good John Wayne impression.
I'm just gonna say it. I love him in this film.
No, he was good. Yeah, he does a lot of mustache acting.
He does. Overall, I thought most of them were pretty good. If we're talking like, I mean, the weakest is maybe Bruce Dern, but he did fine.
Well, actually, I thought he doesn't have a lot to work with. He is like almost a completely silent character, which is strange in a Tarantino film. But he brings a lot of gravity to that. I think if you'd had a lesser actor, it would have been nothing.
I think you might be right.
I think he, you know, he can do more with a look or a flinch of his eye or something like that that says everything you need to know about that character.
Maybe. I just didn't get a lot from him. I of course, he needs to be there, but as a performance, nothing jumped at me. But again, that's not saying much in this film to me. I think all the performances.
That would be Michael Madsen. He wasn't bad, but he wasn't great either. He was just, for me, he was just kind of there. But
a little bit. He would have been a close second for me. So.
All right. Well, I enjoyed the movie. I'd be interested to seeing how I feel about it on subsequent viewings, because I feel like it could tip me either way.
Yeah. And again, some of the big things about being a chamber piece and being in 70, I don't understand. But overall, I really enjoyed the film.
I was talking about this with Keith, actually. I was texting him about the movie.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, he loved it unabashedly because he loves everything ever. But
he's the opposite of a hater.
Right. I brought up, you know, my grievances or whatever. And I said, and part of me was like, well, I wonder if it's like almost like a Godard tricksterism in here that he's like, I'm going to make this film in 70 millimeter with an overture and an intermission, give it this like West Side Story Sound of Music kind of presentation. And it's going to be the meanest, smallest, goriest, like splatter flick I've ever made.
You know what? Maybe. I mean, again, he has that film language to be able to do that.
Right.
And maybe not even. And I mean, if we are talking, like, even if he's not doing it purposefully, maybe it could still be there. He's that kind of a filmmaker.
Yeah.
So I wouldn't count him out on this, even with some of your grievances. I think it's a pretty decent movie.
So let's go ahead and get into our Netflix homework. And that is Queen of Earth, which I assigned you.
Yeah, go ahead and set it up.
This is a small independent film that came out earlier this year, directed and written by Alex Ross Perry, Elizabeth Moss, and Catherine Watterson star in the film as estranged best friends. They don't really see each other all that much anymore. They were probably better friends when they were younger, but they're kind of growing apart as they get older. Elizabeth Moss's character is coming out of a heavy time. Her father recently died, a father who she obviously admired, you know, and was sort of a hero of hers in the art world. She was working with him as an assistant when he committed suicide. And then shortly thereafter, her longtime boyfriend or on again, off again boyfriend breaks up with her. So she goes to meet her friend, Catherine Waterston, in this summer cabin in the woods, although a lot more kind of cabin in the Hamptons style rather than the Wyoming cabin in Hateful Eight. And they kind of realize that they might not really have all that much in common anymore. They're kind of emotionally coming from two different places now. There's this other character played by Patrick Fugit who's kind of lives around the area and I guess what they would refer to as a fuckboy on the internet, who's trying to get on Catherine Waterston and is getting on Elizabeth Moss's nerves. And as the movie progresses, we start to realize that maybe everything that these characters are saying to each other, because it seems like they're all pretty terrible and they all have nothing but venomous backhanded things and attitudes towards each other, we start to realize maybe more and more that what we're seeing is all in her head. I think I said, like, towards the end of the movie, it's like, this is the longest Zoloft commercial I've ever seen. Because, you know, if you remember the old Zoloft commercials with the, like, the bouncing, like, sad pillow thing. And it said, do you ever
get... No, I don't know.
You don't remember those? Do you ever
feel
like... It
might be the way you're describing it.
the bouncing sad pillow. Said, do you ever feel like people are talking about you? Do you ever get to feel nervous in large crowds for no reason? And this movie does some interesting things, I think, with tone. And I think more than anything, it is a tonal piece. But I was a little disappointed with it narratively. I feel like it's building up to something and never really pays anything off. And maybe that's what the director wants to do.
I think that's a nice way to say it. I mean, for time's sake, I'm just going to say it in the most brash way I can. I think it's kind of pretentious twaddle. it is. It doesn't. It's rich people whining about their problems. Mm. Like, I'm sorry, but I know bad things happen to everybody. I get that. It's a lot of, you're talking about characters narrating in your last review. Holy cow, characters narrating in this. That's the, they just narrate at each other.
A monologue.
And it's kind of, ugh. I found this kind of to be just an unsatisfying movie just in general. I can kind of get some of the things you're saying that it's interesting about it tonally, mm-hmm. but overall, I don't think that that really makes up for it just being kind of meandering and kind of just self-absorbed and just characters kind of just talking. Like, it doesn't do anything. To me, it's just kind of a movie that's there, and I won't ever go back to it. I wouldn't really recommend it.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, I didn't love this movie. I didn't even really particularly like it. I don't know if it wants to be liked, though.
I don't know if, I mean, then there, I didn't like it. Like, I mean, that's kind of my, like,
mission,
I mean,
accomplished.
My reaction. Yeah, you got it. I know that there are people that are reacting to this more favorably, but mm-hmm. I just, these aren't ever characters that I'm ever going to be that interested in. I did kind of think, oh, this is all just in, Liz Moth is obviously in this as having kind of a break. And yeah. This is probably all from her point of view.
Right.
I, you know, and I can kind of, I could somewhat sympathize with the, like, character, the back and forth with having a boyfriend when the other one's doing poorly and blah, blah, blah. But overall, the overall quality of the film, it just kind of sank. Like, I just was like, I don't care about these characters. I don't care about the situation. It doesn't move that. I don't feel like it moves very well. And things just kind of happen. So I don't think it's impenetrable by any means. I just don't think it's very good. I think it's somebody trying to stretch their wings, and they just overstretch and they drop all the stuff that they're trying to carry.
Yeah, I mean, that's a succinct way of saying it. I think the reason why I give the movie a little bit more benefit of a doubt, even though, like I said, the overall effect of it is it needed to either do more or do less. I'm not sure. Probably more. Is that I was interested in the perspective angle of it. I was interested of, you know, the unreliable narrator aspect of it. That, you know, once I kind of got the feeling like, oh, everything saying is mm-hmm. not actually how the world is. This is just how she perceives it in right. kind of a Travis Bickle-y kind of way. Obviously to not nearly as good of an execution. Or with as good of a movie to support it, but
and if to me though, if you're going to use a gimmick,
right?
And I mean, that's how I ultimately see an unreliable narrative, as a gimmick. It's an interesting way of telling a very similar story,
right?
Then you have to do it very tightly. This doesn't do it tightly. This is just kind of meandering, and I don't think it fulfills anything it wants to. I think it's just an overall, I think it honestly kind of, it ends up just being coming more of like a stylistic flexing. And that's about the best it can do.
It's certainly, I would agree with you there. I think.
But it's a film that it's by necessity, you have to be kind of like invested in, I mean, with an unreliable narrator, you have to be kind of like drawn towards the character. I was
or the
never
narrative,
drawn,
one or the
or
other.
The narrative,
and
you're not, you're pushed from both. There is real no narrative, and I don't really find the character very interesting.
I think Elizabeth Moss does a pretty good job with what she's given.
Oh, the performances are fine.
And I think the portrayal of psychosis is interesting. I don't think that the story is that interesting. Ultimately, that's my problem with the movie.
I see. I think the psychosis, it purposefully wants to be that, too.
Right.
I do think it purposely wants to, but it
kind of wants to be like a Polanski-ish type thing. It kind of wants...
Right.
In places, I don't know.
If it wants to be like Knife from the Water.
Right.
You know, his first film where this basically happens with two dudes. The two dudes, like, I didn't necessarily like either of those characters, but I liked both. But I liked the story and the narrative. It's just done better. It's executed. Like, it's just executed nicely. And so this one just kind of...
I would agree that there is a film school stench to it.
That's a good way to say it.
Yeah.
I still have to say I couldn't recommend it really to anybody.
No, but what I would say is if you saw this and liked it, then I probably don't need to say this, but if you saw this and liked it, I would say go see Martha, Marcy, May, Marlene, which I think does a lot of the same stuff, but a lot better.
You should just watch that movie.
As sort of a hanging on the wall kind of art piece, I thought it was vaguely interesting. It's just a lot of atmosphere, but...
You know, I can't think of anybody I would necessarily recommend it to.
For me, this is one of those movies where I don't care for this movie, but I would maybe look at the director's other work to see where he might pull off some of these ideas better.
I can agree with that. I think that there is enough atmospheric...
cinematic.
...kind of presence, yeah, that you could come back again for it somewhere.
Yeah. And if you're, you know, just a total fanboy or fangirl for Elizabeth Moss and you just want to see her acting her ass off, maybe overacting even.
it has an old school, like,
there's a melodrama,
old school Hollywood
kind of
melodrama to her performance that isn't, I don't think it's flattering at times, too.
No, and maybe in a way that she's not even aware. Like, I feel sometimes I'm a little embarrassed for her because I think there's a intentional camp to this movie that she as an actress is not aware of, but that the director is aware of. And I feel like maybe she's being manipulated in a slightly unfair way. But, it's whatever.
Yeah. Well, I kind of thought of, like, also, if you're watching this because you saw the preview and you're like, oh, maybe it has like kind of like a 70s throwback, like horror thriller kind of vibe.
Yeah.
Just go watch House of the Devil.
Yeah.
Just do that because you'll be rewarded better. You won't like this one as much.
What did you want to have us watch next week for the Netflix homework?
Well, I wanted to watch Nightmare, but...
Not going to do it. Not going to do it.
If we have enough viewers who voted that you should, I know you won't because you don't get you. If somebody says you should do something, you're more likely not to do it. It's just how you are. I think one day you should just go down for the challenge. So next week we'll be watching the film starring, or at least bits starring Simon Pegg called Kill Me Three Times.
Yeah. Kind of a crime comedy, it looks like. So. If anybody has an opinion on any of the movies we talked about today, and we talked about a lot of movies, you know,
we talked about too many movies.
Too many movies. If what's your overall take on Tarantino? How did you feel about The Hateful Eight? If you happen to see Queen of Earth and you think we're crazy, then you can email us at jabberonthedrone@gmail.com. You can also find us on Facebook at facebook.com/jabberpodcast. We're on Twitter @jabberpodcast. Find us on iTunes or Stitcher Radio, also on the Zune, Pocket Cast, and the Windows Podcast Network. I write reviews. They're on saladforkreviews.blogspot.com. And be sure to check out Brad's webzine at, what is it? What is that? medium.com/panel-frame. Check out Leland's Dampercast over from Olympia, Washington. At dampercast.com. Rod and Denise's The Listening Party. They have a new episode coming out tomorrow. You should check that out. And check out Patrick and Dennis at their show, Almost Educational, as well as Patrick and his dad at Make Dad Read Comics. We're going to have a top 10 of the year, which we're recording tonight. But it will be in a separate episode. So if you haven't listened to that, it should come out within the next few days. A special extra episode this week.
Mm-hmm.
But until then, we'll talk to you later.
Have a good one. Bye.
Bye.